is there's this huge water hole, freezing cold, with like mountain chill, melted snow water at the bottom of it. 30-foot cliff overlooking the water hole. And I jumped in. It was really scary. I'm very scared of heights. And I jumped in, I popped out. And it was like, you're a man now. I felt like the man, but I also felt like a man. That was my rite of passage.
So my guest today is Pierce Freelon. Pierce is born and raised in Durham, and he went on to study at UNC Chapel Hill for undergrad, and then I've just learned Syracuse for grad school. Mm-hmm. And at UNC Chapel Hill, and while he's been here, he developed a hip-hop curriculum that uses beat-making as a tool for learning. The name of that?
Beatmaking Lab.
Beatmaking Lab. And eventually went on to found Blackspace, which is an Afrofuturist digital makerspace, and created the Emmy award-winning PBS series Beatmaking Lab.
Yeah, based on the curriculum.
Now the founder and CEO of Coco Fro, still residing in Durham with this rich history of serving on city council, running for mayor. Your work often brings you at the intersection of education and community. Spent your life at that crossroads. We're really excited to welcome you here today to Tending the Fire. Today I want to talk about what does it mean to become a man, healthy masculinity, rites of passage, as like a core developmental tool for young men. Journeyman works with 13 to 19 year old boys. Is there like a moment or a memory or something that we could understand about your background that led you to becoming the man you are today?
Wow.
Jumping right in.
Yeah. I mean, I had a great dad. I would say my biggest influence was my father, Phil Freelon. He passed away in 2019, so he's now an ancestor. And but he was not alone. Like, the journey to manhood was paved through many wonderful adult men and women who poured into me, people like Baba Chuck Davis, who was a dance teacher and a mentor of mine, my cousin Andre, who would go on camping trips with me and was a really, you know, that crucial space between my dad and me. There's like, you know, that kind of middle area. He was an adult male role model that was closer in age. So I felt he was more relatable. I was less rebellious. I was a rebellious teen for sure.
Yeah.
Very, same. Very obnoxious. So I've heard, and you know, ready to kind of lock horns with my dad and kind of challenge his authority in some ways that I think are retroactively, I'm thinking it was probably healthy. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, I always think of the metaphor of like, you know, in a pride of lions, like when the young male lions start growing their mane, they've got to leave the pride. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, there's something about, it's like there can only be one mane in the pride.
Yeah.
At least during those formative years. I feel like once they go off into the wilderness and come back as peers, like now we could rock together. But while you're in that transit, that crucial transition period where that, your chest is getting a little hairy there, son. Mm-hmm. It's like you need to go off into the woods and have some experiences and come back before I wring your neck. that's kind of the space that the people like my cousin and Baba Chuck and Sister Hanifa, there were like multiple people who helped rein me in those times, including my peers. I don't even just want to talk about the elders in my life. Like, I had homies on sports teams and other settings that were equally important to my formative years. So I think that, you know, the cliche adage, it takes a village to raise a child. I definitely had a village of people helping me figure out what masculinity was and who I was. And that was great.
Curious to talk to guests like yourself around, what have your rites of passage been, particularly with adolescence? And you mentioned your dad and being a caretaker for him. I understand that to be a rite of passage.
Yeah.
Where now you are father to your son and you don't have dad. You have him as an ancestor, but you don't have him in your life in the day to day. But going back a little bit further to like 16 year old Pierce, I'm curious what was going on for you.
Yeah.
And if you could describe that rite of passage, that ceremony that we were talking about on the phone.
Yeah. So when I was 14, my dad and I were butting heads, to put it lightly.
Classic.
And yeah, classic stuff. And he called my cousin Andre, who is 9 years older than me, and was like, "You need to grab your cousin. You need to grab your little cousin and work some stuff out." So we went on a camping trip. It was just the two of us up in New Hampshire. And we rolled out sleeping bags and stayed in a tent. We climbed a mountain. It was me, him, and his dog, Bailey. We talked about everything that I couldn't talk to my dad about. I was challenged physically, emotionally, spiritually. It was really hard on my body, but I felt so accomplished being up there. I felt a sense of connection and brotherhood with my cousin. And then at the end, an interesting baptism at the end is there's this huge water hole that is like freezing cold with like mountain chilled melted snow water at the bottom of it. And there's like this maybe 30-foot cliff overlooking the water hole, and I jumped in. It was really scary. I'm very scared of heights. And I jumped in, I popped out, and it was like, you're a man now coming out of that water. I felt like the man, but I also felt like a man. Mm-hmm. That was my rite of passage. And when the very next year, we went again the next year, and the year after that, my dad joined us, and it was mm-hmm. the three of us. Mm-hmm. And it was a really great bonding experience for all of us. So then when his son, Andre, became a father, when his son turned 14, we took him up the mountain. Mm-hmm. When his youngest son turned 14, we took him up the mountain. When my son turned 14, we took him up the mountain. So it became a ritual that I didn't really think of necessarily as a rite of passage until we started talking about it. It's like, oh, this is a thing that happens when our men in our family are getting into high school, the summer of their middle school to high school year. And I told Justice straight up, my son's now 17. His trip was 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. When he popped out, not everybody decides to jump into the icy cold water at mm-hmm. the end, mm-hmm. but he did. When he popped out of that water, I was like, you're a man now.
Wow.
Like, you made it. As far as I'm concerned, like, we have graduated. I'll always be your father, but we're peers as men.
Yeah.
But
take me back to that moment. So when you were 14,
yeah,
you popped out of the water, and you just had this huge hike, and you're cold. What was different for you after that moment? Did you feel like, what was going on in your head? Did you think, I'm a man now, or what was happening for you?
I don't know that I thought I'm a man now at that time. Yeah. It's only upon reflecting on the experience that I think, like, wow, that was a pivotal moment in my courage, mm-hmm. especially around courage, because, and in terms of hardship, like, I played some sports in middle school, and then I went on to play football and basketball in high school, but I hadn't been challenged physically in that way before. So it was, and then the scaredness of jumping off that cliff was really big.
Moving through fear.
Yeah. And I mean, there was, it was the whole thing. It was like, I was like, I can't see the bottom. He's like, oh, it's deep enough. People have been jumping off this thing for years, but watch out, because if you go down, make sure you don't swim towards that corner, because there are whirlpools form and there's at least a couple drownings here every year. So I'm like, a couple drownings here every year.
So there's real risk.
Like
there is to becoming a man, like there is in the world.
And I'm looking at the whirlpools thinking, okay, how can I aim my trajectory to stay the far away from that little corner so I don't get sucked down? But he was also saying, like, if you do get stuck over there and you get sucked down, like, let it drag you to the bottom and then just swim out from underneath. Like, don't panic.
Whoa.
He was explaining, like, the way people get stuck is trying to fight nature.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, submit to nature and then swim beneath the natural phenomenon of the whirlpool.
I don't have to unpack the metaphor.
Oh my
there's
goodness.
So much beauty. There's so much beauty because there's this like, this is a spiritual experience.
Yeah.
And my guess is you felt the transformative nature of it.
Yeah.
But you couldn't make sense of it in that moment.
Yeah.
But as you got older and learned, you're like, wait, wow, that's like.
Well, you know what's funny? One of the lessons, especially about this swimming hole thing, mm-hmm. I didn't learn until I became a father, because when it was time for Justice's opportunity, first of all, jumping is not mandatory. There are mm-hmm. some kids mm-hmm. who choose not to jump, and that's totally fine.
Challenged by choice.
Totally.
Yep.
So when it became Justice's turn, he was initially willing and then had reservations. And I was like, Justice, this is not a mandatory part of the trip. We love you. You're still with us. And then we were walking back to the car. He's like, I'm going to do it. And then he goes back and does it.
Nice.
But what was wild was when I told my wife about, oh, Justice did the thing. And, you know, I was explaining to her like the whirlpool stuff. She was like, you let my son jump into a life-threatening whirlpool, icy cold water. Why did you do that? And I was like, oh, like, you know, this is why my role in Justice's life is different than his mother's role. Her role is the nurturing role, the protector role. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My role is to set you up to be able to protect yourself and your family.
Yep.
That includes deliberate exposure to danger.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And I don't feel scared about it. I did it. My cousins did it. You can do it.
Yeah.
Like, and just hearing my wife's reaction, I was like, okay, this is why you weren't invited on the trip, honey.
But that's like, exactly why there's the polarization between masculine and feminine.
Exactly.
And it's exactly why, like, in African, like, West African traditions, the men would come, they'd play a specific song on the djembe.
Mm.
It was called Soli in this one community that I'm steeped in, this mm-hmm. tradition. And the women would hear the song. And there's this point in the song where the men, Soli! And they say it really loud. They could hear the men coming. So they knew the men were coming to take the boys into the woods for the rite of passage.
Nice.
And the women would buy in completely. And they go, no.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Don't take it. And they'd take their brooms and their sticks and they'd beat the men
who
were coming to take the boys. But they were in on it.
Yeah.
They were secretly like so excited.
Oh, that's cool.
Because they knew the developmental necessity for boys to be trained in the way, the exact way that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And they knew the power of their intense love being communicated, their intense care being communicated. And so the boy gets both.
Yeah.
He gets the challenge and he gets the nurture.
Yeah.
And I think so much of that is what's missing in today's world, is that we, you know, you have this really rich experience as a second generation initiator.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You've been an initiate, you've gone through your rites of passage.
Yeah.
And now you go back and it's becoming this like rich
familial
legacy. So I'm wondering if there's any stories in your background that really like illustrate this example of learning and becoming a better man through experience. And I'm also wondering if being a dad of two kids, if that's confronted you with more opportunities to learn and grow as a man.
Here's a good example. This is about kind of like my journey in music.
Mm-hmm.
So I make children's music now. I make music for children and families, younger audiences. But before I started making children's music, I would write about, you know, when I was in college, I wrote about college stuff and high school things. Like pretty much all of my music has been a reflection of where I was at the time.
I remember that. I remember seeing you at Shikori.
Oh, yeah.
Your band,
The Beast. Yeah, The Beast.
A couple albums out there.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah. The Beast was great. I really enjoyed The Beast. Before The Beast, I was in a group called Language Arts.
Okay.
And, you know, it's funny. These journalists keep reaching out to me about Language Arts because we had a song called Bulls Up where we would throw the bulls up. And now Duke is using this as their, like, main thing.
Whoa.
And there's, like, this, apparently this Reddit thread that, where people are like, oh, like Language Arts started that, which we didn't start it, by the way.
Oh, I was going to say, you started this?
Well, I think we were the first. This was like early 2000s. We were the ones to popularize it.
Got
like
it.
Bulls Up was like a song that was played on the radio and was quite popular around Durham at a time when Durham was not very popular, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it was a way to show like pride in our city and in our culture and in our community. And it kind of, you know, this was before Facebook Instagram and TikTok were invented, YouTube didn't exist when we put this song out. We were, our video was up on MySpace, if you remember that.
Nice.
So like, you know, but anyway, that was like, that the music that I wrote at that time isn't reflective of like who I am and where I'm at now. So when I had to go find the track and I was like listening to some of the old stuff, I was just like, I'm not that guy anymore. Mm. I was like a single young like college student at the time. So, you know, the lyrics reflected accordingly. So what was funny was I had kids pretty young. My wife and I got married, I think I was 23 or 24. Wait, was that? Yeah, I was 25, maybe 24 when we got married, 25 when our son was born. Mm-hmm. And when I was a young parent, I used to write songs about, I mean, like our kid, like jumping up in our bed and, you know, just parenting stuff. Mm-hmm. But it was funny because in The Beast was like this like political rap group, mm-hmm. like, you know, Black Star, or The Roots, you know, or Lauryn Hill, like that. Those were the influences. So there wasn't really room to write about like being a dad. It just wasn't relevant mm-hmm. to what The Beast was about, you know, playing festivals like Shikori or the Winter Jazz Festival or whatever. So I kind of like sat on those songs or would hide them. Mm. Not like because I was scared for someone to listen to them, just because it wasn't like a great fit. And it wasn't until, and so, but you know, as my kids continued to age, like, I don't control what I write about. Like it's like I was writing a song about like, this is how you buckle your seatbelt, brush your teeth, like go to bed. Like everything that was a part of my experience as a young dad began to creep into my lyrics more and more. And so that I would save them on my phone as voice notes, voice memos, and would just kind of tuck them away. And then occasionally I would have a song about like cost of living or about, you know, capitalism. And then that would actually become a song that ended up on an album about police brutality, whatever. Mm-hmm. So, you know, political rap song, like, would go in this category. Songs about being a dad would go in this category. And these songs never got developed, never got written, recorded, anything. And so then in 2019, well, it was about 2017, my dad got diagnosed with ALS. Mm-hmm. And I was at that time, like, a touring artist doing Beat Making Lab. We were traveling all over the world. And, you know, all that came to a screeching halt when my dad got sick, because I shifted from like world traveler to like primary caregiver for my dad, along with my mom and my siblings. I was just with him a lot. And in the solitude of that caregiving space, I would sit with my dad and share with him mostly like home videos, like, oh, check out this video from, you know, Justice's third birthday, or remember that time we went on this family trip or whatever, just like scrolling through my phone, pulling out old VHS tapes and stuff to just reminisce with him, because he was in a wheelchair and, you know, we didn't have much else to do. So we did some like reminiscing. And occasionally I would scroll through voice memos and I would find these like songs that I had written in previous years. Mm-hmm. And that was also a time where I was reflecting a lot on what fatherhood was, what my dad was to me, who I am to my kids. The fragility of life was top of mind, because as I'm reflecting and watching these videos of me, the age that my kids are now, I'm also thinking like, wow, I'm not going to be around forever. You know, one day I'm going to die and my kids are going to have to carry on without me. Like, there was just this really profound reflection on what fatherhood has meant to me and as a child and as a dad. And what was interesting was this body of work. I had like 300 songs about every parenting topic you could possibly imagine. Mm-hmm. And then I started, this goes to the creative piece, I started getting curious and creative around like, let me work. Some of these are kind of like, this is kind of a bop. Yeah. Like, some of these tracks kind of go hard. So I started writing songs. And by the time my dad passed away, like right before he passed, I had like finished an album of children's songs. Mm. And I was able to play it for him, you know, headphones on. And oh, this is my song, Daddy Daughter Day. This is my song about boundaries. This is my song about consent. This is my song about, you know, make new friends, but keep the old. Some are silver, the other are gold. Like different sayings that my dad taught me, different values, different things. And my dad died in 2019. That first album came out in 2020. And I have not turned away from children's music since then. Mm-hmm. In the first album, I wasn't desiring to go into children's music professionally. Mm-hmm. It was really just like a love note to my dad. The album was called DAD. Mm-hmm. And it was just reflections on fatherhood. But that first body of work was so popular that I was like, wow, there's really a market for this. There wasn't a lot of media out there that centered like a nurturing Black fatherhood in children's music, at least. And so I kind of followed my nose and released my next album, Black to the Future, which was nominated for a Grammy. And then our next album, Ancestars, was also nominated for a Grammy. And then I started writing children's books and all this other stuff. So, like, I mean, I think for me, the moral of that story, going back to embracing your authentic voice, is with The Beast, which all the work I did with The Beast was also authentic. There was like a large part of myself that I was not giving voice to. It was just kind of like languishing in a vault somewhere where nobody could hear it. The songs were coming through me, but I wasn't putting them out because I didn't think there was space for them in my creative voice. And it was really facing the mortality of my dad's transition from this world to the next that caused me to be curious about that voice that I had kind of squashed, that voice that was really dad, that was the voice. And then I found a lot of success professionally and otherwise in my heart space. It was like a grieving tool for me, but it was also, it was crazy because it was also a very creative, like I was able to bring all the experience that I gained from language arts, all the production and musicianship that I learned from The Beast. And so my children's music has all that in it too. It's just the lyrics are about fatherhood. And I think like that giving myself permission to delve into the fertile grounds of my own creativity as it relates to fatherhood was like the best career decision I could have made.
Yeah.
Because like to this day, like I'm getting millions of streams on my children's songs, and those Great Beast songs are still in the tens of thousands, you know, it's just not nearly as popular or profitable. And even like with my books and with Coco Fro, these are continued explorations in the children's media space, which I think, like, I know you do mentorship with older teens. I'm trying to get them before they're teens.
Yeah.
Can we start to have conversations around consent and courage and boundaries and vulnerability? Like those are conversations that I'm having with the kids before they graduate to a journeyman experience. And this was part of my upbringing and part of how I raised my own children.
There's so much in that. And I want to. Because what I keep hearing in what you're saying, Pierce, is this concept of rites of passage. And you've kind of laid out like getting married, becoming a dad, like being with your dad, being a caregiver with your dad, and then him passing. These are all, in my mind, I understand these as rite of passage, right? Ceremonies of maturity.
Yeah.
That were, and the way you're describing them is they've been held and honored in a way that isn't just casual. Right. Even like, for example, your experience of your artistic expression in The Beast and then writing kids music. Like, I think what I see there is pretty unique experience in that I think we're the first generation. You're a little bit older than me, but we're the first generation to have this this kind of like history that is static of who we were. Right. Everything's on the internet. It's published for everyone to see. And so I feel like the generations prior to us, they would change, they would become a new person, and the only people who knew that were around them.
Yeah.
Right? It wasn't like published forever. I mean, unless you could have written like a newspaper or a column or whatever. But I think what's unique about this generation and this moment is that we have these snapshots in time. And I think in our society, without rites of passage, we then like expect people to be the same way. It's not growth. And we say like who you were back then needs to be who you are forever. And if it's not, you're a liar. Coming from where you were to where you are now, I'm curious, Pierce, today, how you would describe or define healthy masculinity. It's kind of the question at the center of Journeyman is we're not telling the answer. We have an answer.
Yeah.
But we're encouraging the culture and the world and really where we are in Raleigh, North Carolina, and the Triangle in engaging in this question. I think there's been a lot of talk and conversation defining toxic masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
And we're really pushing forward. But what is healthy masculinity?
Yeah.
It's not just the opposite of toxic is kind of our premise.
Sure.
Without leading the witness too much, I'm curious today, how would you define healthy masculinity?
Well, you know, it's funny. I think there's a lot of theory and really ancient philosophy around what is masculine and what is feminine. Mm-hmm. I think recently there's been some interesting dialogue around, well, is it a binary? Is it a spectrum? Mm-hmm. Is it a three-dimensional thing? And everybody just kind of exists somewhere else, somewhere unique on the kaleidoscope of really humanity. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, where I sit in that is I haven't studied it. I just kind of know intuitively what I feel. And I feel that there's masculine and feminine and queer energy, God energy, whatever you want to call it, human energy in all of us. And I think for me as a man, as a father, as a mentor, I think one of the core tenets of my human experience is like authenticity is really important, kind of knowing who you are and expressing it unapologetically. I think doing what you say you're gonna do is another important part. Mm-hmm. Like your word being your bond is an important part. Again, for my humanity, not necessarily my masculinity specifically. Mm-hmm. And then I think another important one for me, another value, let's see, yeah, authenticity, kind of follow through on your word. And I would say this is a more of a multifaceted one. I would call it ikigai, which is like kind of the purposeful living, your purpose, your reason for being. Knowing that is an important part of how I perform masculinity in the world. And my purpose includes fathership. It includes being a husband. It includes mentoring others. It includes, building Afrofuturistic systems and spaces. And so showing up in that purpose with authenticity and with integrity, I guess is what you could call doing what you say you're going to do, are how I kind of ground my humanness. And then, you know, I think there's a lot of masculinity within that humanness. So, Yeah.
When I look out into the world and the society, I feel like a lot of what you mentioned in some places, and at least in some of the popular stories we hear, is missing. Mm. And we could use more of that, right? Integrity, accountability. When you think about our context here in the Triangle, do you think there's, what do you think is missing the most when it comes to like role models who can embody that, when it comes to creating pathways for young men to see themselves in that kind of vision?
So as an artist, I see a lot of influence coming through culture. Mm-hmm. And, as Black people in America, there's an interesting legacy of kind of the stripping away of culture and then the reintroduction of a new type of culture. Mm-hmm. So like sometimes I reflect longingly on what it must have been like for my ancestors to discover manhood through different rituals. And it's tough not knowing exactly where your folks come from ancestrally. I mean, I can trace my roots back 3 or 4 generations, 5 maybe. But then it kind of stops because the slave trade didn't really provide tools for us to know where we came from fully, or for some of us more than others. But for African Americans whose ancestors were enslaved, there's kind of like there's a gap there where you can't, you don't know, you don't have access to those technologies and those practices and those rituals that may have been really important. Now, what replaced those rituals? Well, the institution of slavery had its own set of harmful rituals that were about subservience and control and that were inflicted trauma upon the psyches of some of our foremothers and fathers that are still part of how we cope with conflict and trauma today. So, and you see that sometimes reflected through culture. And I think, you know, hip hop culture, especially after the 90s, there's a lot of violence there. There's a lot of kind of reactionary behavior. We were talking just before this about Dreamville, right? J. Cole, great rapper. I was just telling my friend the other day, what he did at the last Dreamville in opting out of the conflict between Kendrick Lamar and Drake was such a powerful gesture of like maturity. And like, it was almost, in some ways, a lot of people were calling him a pussy or like, you know, a sellout or like weak. And in hip hop, those are dangerous words. Like, you calling me a pussy? Like, I'll fight you. I'll shoot you. Like, it could really escalate quickly. Mm-hmm. But I thought not only did he handle those critiques gracefully, but he stood in his authenticity, opting out of a conflict. You know, when you're challenged, you're supposed to bark back. You know what I mean? When you're bitten, you're supposed to bite back. When you're swung at, you're supposed to swing back. So what J. Cole did, you know, which was so radically different, was his initial reaction was the predictable one. He wrote a song dissing Kendrick Lamar. But then at Dreamville, which was maybe a week after the track was released, he had some time to think about what he did, and he actually walked back. He took the song off streaming platforms. He apologized and was like, I don't want anything to do with this conflict. You know, and to me, when you talk about Raleigh culture, and when you talk about Dreamville as a cultural institution for hip hop in Raleigh, and J. Cole is one of the most respected names in rap from North Carolina, Fayetteville, but, you know, really based his cultural movement in Dreamville here in Raleigh. I think that you have a radical reimagination of what masculinity looks like in hip hop and one that is very healthy, right? Because, you know, if you think about rap beef, the quintessential rap beef of my childhood being Biggie and Pac, both men being murdered over poems that they've written about one another. You know what I mean? Like, that's how that is, to me, is a legacy of some of the harmful treatment and enslavement and the dignity lost. It's so, when your ancestors have been stripped of their names, their rituals, their food, their language, everything about them, then dignity becomes very important for a traumatized or the child of a traumatized environment. It is way more profitable. It is way more popular. It is way more cool to respond fire with fire and to respond violence with violence and to escalate and to see how far you can take the violence. And that's not just the culture of hip hop. That's the culture of Donald Trump, American imperialism, capitalism. Like, you know, you're not looking to just defeat the other companies in your industry. You're trying to destroy them. You know, like, that's American culture. It's as American as apple pie. So I don't just want to put that on hip hop. But I think that there's a particular type of security and a special type of masculinity that can hold the cultural expectations that you're supposed to be in conflict with someone and actually regulate your nervous system, really think about what your values are, and then move according to those values, despite people thinking that's going to make you look like a weak person. I see it as a form of profound integrity, strength, authenticity, power, masculinity. The question you ask is what's missing. Yeah. What's missing is that J. Cole energy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, what's present is like beef escalating into murder, conflict bubbling over into really, it's funny, like what's seen as masculine is like, yeah, if you insult me, like I'll fuck you up. Like that's seen as masculinity, yeah. But that's actually an absence of control, it's a weakness.
No.
Isn't that wild? Yeah. But then we live in this crazy world where that scene is like, oh, the hardest guy in my community is the one who don't take shit from nobody. Like it's a reversal of what masculinity actually is in terms of control and power and dignity and kind of purposefulness as opposed to like, I'm so vulnerable to what you said that I'm dysregulated and I'm willing to do anything now. Mm-hmm. Like I've taken you out of your power with just some words. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. So that's what's missing. What's missing is the measured, disciplined, I guess this is what I think masculinity is. I couldn't answer the question earlier, but it's that discipline. It's the ability to control your own destiny within yourself, right? There's certain things that are outside of you that you can't control, but you can control your response to that. And being able to be in that divine alignment with how you react to any situation, to me, is the essence of masculinity.
Ooh, that's really good.
Yeah.
I like what you weave together there, because I opened up the conversation around what, like, toxic masculinity is a conversation most people are having, and what is healthy masculinity? That's kind of what Journeyman is trying to push forward in the culture and in our society. And you brought in this really prescient example of J. Cole as like, he's actually leading that charge, whether he knew it or not. I'm not sure if it was a conscious decision or if it was him in his maturity, in his groundedness, in his masculinity saying, you know what, this is not, maybe let's do something different.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to close with this poem by Hafiz, and it's called The Warrior. And I think it really embodies what we do with Journeyman. So the warriors tame the beast in their past so that the knight's hooves can no longer break the jeweled vision in the heart. The intelligent and the brave open every closet in the future and evict all the mind's ghosts who have the bad habit of barfing everywhere. For a long time, the universe has been germinating in your spine, but only a saint has the talent, the courage to slay the past giant, the future anxieties. The warrior wisely sits in a circle with other men, gathering the strength to unmask himself. Then sits, giving like a great illumined planet on the earth.
That's great.
Right?
I love that. I love that there's, we were talking earlier about presence, and there's this giant past, anxious future. Mm-hmm. Those are like the foes of illumination, and the idea of just being present is seems implied there. That's beautiful. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah, the line that stuck out to me this time was, the warrior wisely sits in circle with other men.
With other men.
So thanks for being one of those men.
Yeah, thank you.
Sitting in the circle.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it. It's fun.
Yeah, looking forward to it. And next time, we'll get J. Cole on. Okay. The three of us will talk about the beef and what it means to be a good man in the rap subculture there.
I love it. Yeah, I would love to be a part of that.
Cool. Pierce Freelon, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
Tending the fire. Excited to see you guys again soon.